Okay, we're going next piece of Gemara on Makos, Tes Amud Beis 9b. The Mishnah where Rav Yossi says, Hasone Nerag, someone that's an enemy of a person. Okay, so Rav Yossi says he's killed. Remember, there was a machlokas over there. We had Tana Kama says a sone does not go into Golas. Rav Yossi says a sone gets killed because he's like a muad. It's like he's forewarned. And then Rav Shimon says sometimes a sone goes into exile. Sometimes a sone does not go into Golas. What's the rule? If we can attribute that he did it intentionally, he gets killed. He doesn't go into Golas. I mean, he didn't. It was purely a shogeg. He does go into Golas. So we're starting with the... We're frozen now. We're going to get to the middle opinion of Rav Yossi says, Hasone ha'nerag mipnei shehu kamuad. Okay, there we are. So he said, now the question we asked when we were learning it, how can you kill the sone, the hating guy, because he's a muad? It's like he's forewarned, but you have to have a warning. Where's the warning? You don't kill anybody unless there's a warning. We could send you to Golas without a warning, but we can't kill you without a warning. So how could you kill him? And that's Gemara's question. V'halo Astrube. But there was obviously no warning over there. You can't be punished without a warning. So the answer is, Masnisin, this Rav Yossi, he holds like Rav Yossi bar Yehudahi. Okay, now it's interesting. Look at the notes. Rav Yossi, who's mentioned in our Mishnah, is generally Rav Yossi bar Chalafta, unless otherwise specified. Our Mishnah is an exception in that it refers to Rav Yossi bar Yehuda simply as Rav Yossi without mentioning his father's name. So this Rav Yossi, even though it's normally Rav Yossi ben Chalafta, this is Rav Yossi ben Yehuda. And what is his opinion? He's consistent with his opinion. Detanya Rav Yossi ben Yehuda Omer, Chaver, a scholar, a person who knows Torah. Eina Tzarech Hasra does not need a warning when he kills somebody. Why not? Because the only reason we have warning is so we can discriminate between a person's action if they were unintentional or intentional. That's why you have to warn him. How do we know if he intended doing what he didn't or didn't intend to do? So let's say the guy is Machal Shabbos. The guy's walking over the light switch. Now, is he going purposely to turn on the light switch knowing that it's Shabbos?
No.
Or is he unintentional? We don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't know. As you see him walking towards the lights. You don't have a lot of time to react here. Either you're going to warn him or you're not going to warn him. Right? If you just see a guy walk over, even in the middle of, let's say, in shul,
yes.
Someone goes and turns on a light switch, you can't assume he did it intentionally. Could be he forgot, or you're used to turning on light switches.
Or accidental.
So you don't know. So what are you going to testify in court? We saw him turn on the light switch. Shkoyach. Now, did you find out why he turned on the light switch? Was it intentional? I said, well, I didn't ask. I'm sorry, we can't kill him. So that's why you have to warn him. When you warn him and say, do you know it's Shabbos? Yeah. Do you know that's a light switch? Yeah. You know a lot of that? Yeah. Nah. You know you're going to get killed for that? Yeah. Okay, now I gave a warning. Now he can get killed. So now that's why you need to do that. Now, what if the guy is a scholar? Now, one thing's clear, he knows it's Shabbos. Yeah. He knows he's not allowed to do this on Shabbos. So under that circumstance, you would not have to warn him because you know he knows you're not allowed to do it. Okay, now we're going to have to add something to that. But be that as it may, so therefore, Rav Yossi says when there's a rule you have to warn him, it's only because of certain issues that exist that we have to know in order to kill the person. But if those issues don't exist, then what do you have to warn him for? Now, quite often, a person doesn't know the halacha. An ignorant Jew walks in, so he may not know the halacha, so you have to warn him. You say, you may not know this, but you cannot turn a light switch on Shabbos. Now, one of two things can happen. The guy says, oh, thank you, I won't turn it on. Or the guy will say, I know it's Shabbos, I'm going to turn it on anyway. Okay, thank you, we're going to kill you. Okay, so, but if the guy's a scholar, there's no doubt that he knows the halacha, and therefore you don't have to warn him. However, that's not enough, because you'd still have to know if he forgot it was Shabbos or not. So that you'd have to still know, because there's 2 points to this. There's 2 points to kill the guy. Number one, he has to know it's prohibited, A, and B, he has to know that it's Shabbos. Let's say he's a scholar and he knows it's prohibited, but he just, by, you know, middle of the night, he just went to the bathroom and flicked on the switch, forgot it was Shabbos. Even a scholar can forget that. So we've got to really know everything. So if you know that he knows and he's a scholar, then, and let's say a scholar who went off the derech. Guy goes to yeshiva, fine, upstanding scholar, and then he went off. He went off. So now, you know he knows, and you know he knows it ain't Shabbos. Right, he's lighting up a cigarette. I think that'd be more likely. I don't know anybody who, an Orthodox Jew, who lights a cigarette, who lit a cigarette on Shabbos Peshogeg. Yeah. You know, turning on the light, I could hear.
Light I could hear.
But cigarette, you got to do a lot of action. First of all, you have to have the cigarettes in your pocket. Yeah. Usually, you're not going to have your cigarettes in your Shabbos suit.
A lighter.
Right? And a lighter, and a whole bunch of things. And it's Shabbos. You know, it's like, it takes a bit of time to light a cigarette as opposed to turning on the lights. So therefore, if the offender is a scholar who assumedly knows the law, warning is not needed for this purpose. Rabbi Yossi is ruling in our Mishnah, when an enemy does not require warning, applies to an enemy. Now he has to add, the comments add. Now enemy, what does it help if he's an enemy? We know he wants to kill the guy. But you got to add, the Ritva adds a point. The case here where we kill the guy who's an enemy, he also has to be a scholar. Why? Because the enemy may not know that you can't kill the guy. Omer mutter. There's a machlokas there. Omer mutter, if it's chayiv or not, right? So therefore, you got to also, so it only applies this Mishnah that says that the hated guy, well, we know he want to do it. We have to also, he's a scholar, for him to know that it is prohibited to do as well. So we have to add that.
A scholar can be an enemy?
Sure. Just because he's a scholar means he's a tzaddik.
But he knows better than that.
A scholar is one thing, a tzaddik is another. There are many people who are scholars who are rishayim. Who are rishayim. You know, you have lots of secular Bible critics. You know, who are... I'm sure there are some reform rabbis who are scholars.
They're still ignorant, though.
But they're Rishayim, right? So what can you do? So just because a guy learns Torah doesn't mean he's going to follow it. You'd assume so, but he could. Now, a warning fills another function as well. It serves to establish that the perpetrator intended to commit the act for which he is now being punished. To this end, the warning must inform him of all the circumstances surrounding the act that make it forbidden. For example, he may have to be told that his intended target was a person, not an animal. Remember, he's shooting. He says, wait a minute, I see you got a rifle there. You're about to shoot into the bush. Do you know that there's a person there? Oh, I thought it was an animal. Well, it's not. It's a person. Let's say the guy didn't bring his glasses. You have to remember, in the times of Gomorrah, did they have glasses? No. Do you think everybody had perfect vision in the times of Gomorrah? Certain things we assume, well, everybody's got 20/20 vision. Now, Tony, if you take off your glasses and you're out in the country and you're at 100 yards away, right? And you want to hunt moose. You want to hunt moose. Now, even with the blur, I think you could see something moving.
Yeah. Motion, yeah.
Okay, now see that's don't you understand why it's not so hard? How far away? 100 feet?
Yeah.
Right? Take off your glasses. What do you see there?
Blurry.
So the guy, now the guy shouldn't hunt because he has good eyesight. He shouldn't hunt. He's going to starve to death. So you shoot. So that's how these accidents can happen, right? So, or that this food was from a non-kosher animal, or the day was Shabbos, etc., etc. In the case of an enemy, though, a warning is not required for this purpose, because there's no doubt that he intended to commit murder. That's the point. If he's in it, it's too coincidental that he hates the guy's guts and he takes a rifle and shoots him.
So weren't you supposed to try and prevent that?
Yes. So fine. So what if we didn't? What if we couldn't warn him?
Couldn't.
We couldn't. We're walking. You're walking the forest, Sammy. And all of a sudden, you see Mr. Schwartz, who you know hates Mr. whatever. Yeah. And you see he shoots him. And you didn't have time to warn him. Okay, so he still get killed because he didn't need a warrant. And he's a scholar. Mr. Schwartz is a scholar. He's a scholar. And yesterday in shul, you saw him fighting with this other guy. I hate your God, so I'm going to kill you. Okay? And the next day, you walk in the forest. And before you're ready to open it, stop! Too late. That's the situation. Now, it emerges that if the enemy is not a scholar, who would need to be told that murder is forbidden and it's punishment, mm-hmm. but he would not have to be informed of the circumstances surrounding this particular act of murder. You know that's a person? You don't got to ask that. In the case of a scholar who is not an enemy, the reverse is true. He'd have to be informed of the act's circumstances, but not of its forbidden nature. So you got to go both ways over here. The only way it comes out, you can kill a guy without a warning, according to Rabbi Yossi, is he's a scholar that you know is an enemy, right? Or a scholar and you know that he knows that what he's doing is wrong. So the case of an enemy scholar works out the best. Because since you know he's an enemy, you know he wants to kill the guy. And he's a scholar, he knows he's not allowed to do that. On the other hand, a scholar does another avera, he may not be aware, let's say, that it's Shabbos. I mean, that could be a problem. The preceding follows the opinion of Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda. So we've explained according to Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda. But that's not the majority view of the Gemara. According to the majority Tanaic view, a warning is required by biblical decree in every situation, even when it's clear the defendant knew what he was doing and that it was forbidden, etc., etc. This is not the mainstream opinion. And therefore, we do not say that, according to Rabbi Yossi, we were saying in the Mishnah, Rabbi Yossi, asone nerag, we don't paskin like that.
He's so not. He does need a warning.
He does need a warning.
Okay. Scholar or not.
We don't paskin like that. Yeah. We say xeris hakosav. Okay, next, final opinion, Rabbi Shimon Omer. Rabbi Shimon says, sometimes there's a sone who goes into exile, sometimes there's a sone who does not go into exile. So now we're going to bring a brisa that is going to explain it, and then we're going to bring a contradiction in Rav Shimon. Tanya, we learned in a brisa, we're going to clarify Rav Shimon's position. Ketzad, in what situation? No. Amar Rav Shimon, in what situation Rav Shimon say, Yesh Sone Gola, there's a case where the Sone goes into exile, but Yesh Sone Shene Gola, the Sone does not go into exile. This is the way we could determine that. Nifsak, if the rope broke, he's lowering a rope down.
Is it the
Brisa? The Brisa. And it breaks. Well, then, Goyla, he goes into exile. Because it's lowering. The rule is, when you're lowering something, you have to be careful. Even if it's unintentional. It's obvious it's unintentional. Even though he's a Sone, if you want to kill the guy, you don't, you know, you can't premeditate a broken rope as you're lowering something down. If you want to kill the guy, you don't lower something and hope the rope's going to break. Yeah. On the other hand, nishmat, but if it slips out of his hand, ain't a gola. He does not go into exile because it's more to the intentional, and therefore going to gos will not be enough of a kapara for him.
So we kill him.
No. Well, that's another discussion. We don't kill him, but it could very well be that the Gol Hadam, the closest relative, can kill him. Remember, when a guy kills unintentionally, what's the halacha? The closest relatives can kill him. But he has a way out. He goes into exile. So here it's a big debate. If he hasn't gone to exile, but what about the fact that the closest relative can kill him? Right? So that becomes an issue. Yeah?
The guy's a big family. Can all of his family be a Gol Hadam? Like the guy's 12 brothers and sisters, and oh man,
yeah,
touches one guy.
yeah. Now, so that's clear. So the rope breaks, doesn't he goes into Gaulus because that's a pure unintentional killing. If it slips, then he can't go into Gaulus. It's not good enough for him. The crime is too great for that. Now we're going to bring a contradiction from another brisa that seems to contradict this brisa. It's the same Reb Shimon. Vatanya Reb Shimon Omer, but we learn the Brisa Shimon says, La'olam ein agoyla, you never go into exile. At she yishmat machatzalso miyado, unless the trowel slipped out of his hand and killed somebody. So he's saying slipping does go into golus, the opposite of the brisa we just said. We just said before that if it slips, it's more intentional, and we can't send him to golus. It's not good enough for that, right? So that, and that's the only time you go into golus. If that means the only time, that means slipped goes into golus. Mm-hmm. What about breaks?
No golus.
Doesn't golus. So they're contradicting both statements of the brisa.
Exactly the opposite.
He was using a trowel to plaster, and it slipped. So, kasha, we have now a contradiction in the two brises.
Sure.
Nifsek on nifsek. If a contradiction between one brise's ruling of broke and broke, the first mishnah, when it breaks, he goes into golus. The second one says, you only go to golus when it slips out, meaning if it breaks, you don't go into golus. Yeah. And then kasha, nishmat and nishmat. There's a contradiction between slipping and slipping. Where the first brise says slipping, he doesn't go into golus because it's worse of a crime. Where the second one says, the only time you go into golus is by slipping. So how are we going to answer that? So Gemara is going to answer each case as follows. Nifsek on nifsek lo kasha, slipping on slipping is not a question. You got to remember that the second brisa never said anything about an enemy. You got to remember, there were, let's go back. Let's make this clear. Look at this little nuance. The first brisa says, Tanya Ketzer Amar Rabbi Yossi Yesh Sone Gola. What did Rabbi Yossi mean that an enemy is sent into exile? And we explained it. Mm-hmm. Look at the next price. It says the word enemy, right? Mm-hmm. Look at the next price. So though, that Tanya Rabbi Shimon Omer, he doesn't say the word Sone. He says the Olam ain't a Gola. You never go into Golas. Until it slips out of his hand. He never said the word Sone in the second price. We assumed it was. So Nagmar's answer, no, it's not a kasha. Ha, the second brisa, when we talk about slip, is talking about Olev, where he liked the guy. So then slipping, that becomes the ones, and that becomes the shogeg, and you go into exile. But the first brisa clearly said the word sone, v'habesone, and that's why the guy hates him. So that takes care of that. But it won't fix up the second case of slipping. Right. So that won't help, even if you're going to say one's beloved and one's not, because that won't work by slipping. So you have to have another answer for slipping. Nishbat anishmat. One second. See, so
now we're talking about a broken one.
Nishmat anishmat, right? Lo kasha ha rebbe. Rabbanan. Remember we talked about the case, the machlokas Rebbe Rabbanan, when you're chopping the wood?
Yeah.
And they had a machlokas, what is the case of exile? Yeah. Remember, what was the pasuk talking about? Was it talking where the chip flew out?
Or
the handle flew out? Yeah. One says you go into Golis, one says you don't. So therefore, this Rebbe Shimon, one Bryce is going to be like Rebbe when it slipped out, and one's with it. Let's read it inside. This second brisa, which does not impose exile in the case of breaking, follows Rebbe, who rules that a woodchopper is not exiled if the head of his axe flew off the handle and killed someone. Just as Rebbe does not impose exile for an axe that broke, leaving the handle in his hand, so he does not impose exile in the case of other objects that break and leave a piece in his hand. Okay? Does not go into exile. Vaha, and the other brisa, Rabbanan, is a rabbi's rule that one whose axe broke is exiled. So that's this. He's bringing different opinions. So in summary, an enemy is generally not exiled because he is suspected of having killed intentionally. That's the general rule. And therefore, exile isn't good enough for him. However, the killing could not have been intentional. Reb Shimon rules that even an enemy is exiled because he didn't really mean to kill him. It was not intentional. It could not have been intentional. Then we go to the default position of Gullus. Therefore, where death results from something slipping from the perpetrator's hand, enemy is not exiled because such an accident could have been intentional. Only a person who is not an enemy is exiled for such a death, but where a death results from something that breaks, Scripture maintains that even an enemy cannot be considered to have killed intentionally. However, the question of whether anyone is exiled in the case of something that breaks depends on a separate issue, the dispute between Rebbe and the sages. According to Rebbe, no one, neither friend or foe, is exiled for it. According to sages, as an exile for such a mishap, hence in their view, even an enemy can be exiled for death resulting from the object that breaks. It follows from this that according to Rebbe, there's no case in which Rav Shimon would exile an enemy. According to Rebbe, if the object slipped, only a friend is exiled, not an enemy. And if broke, no one is exiled. So it would come out that would never work out in that case. Okay, good. That's the end of that piece.
Question.
Well, yes, sir.
Why is it okay for someone who's exiled, but before he gets there, the close relative can go and kill him?
Torah says so.
Yeah, but... Yeah, I know that. But I mean, is there some logic to that? I mean, it's murder, right? The guy did an inadvertent...
Again, this is not... We have to remember now. Yeah. This is not an accident. Remember, there's three categories.
Right.
If it's a total accident...
That's what I'm saying. If it's a total accident...
No one can kill him. No one can kill him.
Okay.
Shogeg means there was a degree of negligence.
Right.
You weren't careful.
Right.
You weren't careful.
Right.
If you're speeding on Bathurst, if you're road raging on Bathurst, you're going 140 kilometers on Bathurst and Clark. 140 kilometers.
Right.
And you run a red and you kill a pedestrian, that clearly would be shogeg. We would go to exile for that.
Yeah.
Now, clearly, he didn't plan on killing anybody. He did not plan on killing anybody. He's an idiot, but he wasn't planning on killing anybody. Now, let's say, God forbid, that's your child who got killed. All right? Now, what would you say? He murdered him. How could he be so stupid? But he didn't intend to kill him. So the Torah understands that this fellow has to go into exile, and he has to go to exile. And he can't not, and he has to make sure he stays in exile. So now we have to make sure he stays, so the family can kill him whenever he's not there.
Yeah.
But again, the two rabbis walk with the guy till he gets into exile to dissuade the people from killing him.
Right.
So that there is a certain degree of the family of the victim have certain rights. Right, just like if a person intentionally kills somebody and gets a death penalty, who's the one that tosses him off the cliff?
Yeah.
Either witnesses or the member of the family, because they get a little bit of revenge, but in a good way. So not revenge.
No.
But it's when somebody gets killed, there's many bad things about it. There's many bad things about getting killed. One of them is you've put the person down in the worst way possible. In other words, I can insult you and that puts you down, right? But if I really want to put you down, I put you down. I kill you. Okay? That's the biggest put down to a person. You're the child of a person who got put down like that. That's devastating. Now, what would you want to do as much as possible? You'd like to restore your father's dignity. So how do you restore that? You try to, as much as possibly, bring your father back to life. You know, you can't. But if you kill the guy who killed him, it restores your father's life to a certain degree that he was able to, get justice, so to speak. So who deserves to do that if not the family? So that's the same idea when you kill unintentionally. So the Torah understands the emotions and to have them do that.
But if there's no degree of negligence,
then he does not go into exile and they cannot kill him. A total accident is a total accident. You cannot. That we call Bashir. That we call Bashir. You're going 30, 40 kilometers on Bathurst and Clark. 40 kilometers. And a pedestrian jumps in the street in front of you. Okay, you feel bad. You killed the guy, but you can't feel guilty. I was driving 40. Care about looking both ways, both hands on the wheel, and a kid just jumps right in front of you, while he's texting. Right? I mean, I almost killed somebody a while ago. It was, I'm making a left turn. I'm making the left. There's no walk. You know, what do you call it? At Atkinson and Center.
Yeah, yeah.
I have the arrow.
Yeah.
I'm going, and the guy's texting, going through. I almost hit him. You know, and if I would have killed him, I would not go into Golis for that. Because that's not my fault. Okay.
So, Rabbi, one more question.
Yeah.
So, if there is negligence, so he has to go into exile. But before he goes into exile, the family member kills that person. But there's no warning given to the family member, don't kill. Because he doesn't get punishment.
He can kill him.
No,
they can't kill him yet because we have to determine what it was.
Right.
We can't kill him at all in the beginning because we got to know, was it intentional, was it unintentional? If it's intentional, the family member can kill him in the court. If it's unintentional...
Without any punishment, just kill him.
They can't kill him right away. You got to wait.
After it is.
When a guy kills, any murderer first goes into the city of refuge.
Right.
Then he's brought back by the court. And then they decide what to do. And then he's brought back with agents. Then is the time where he could get killed. Okay, let's move on now to a totally separate area within exile. Now we're going to get into the meat and potatoes of the cities of refuge themselves. How many were there? Where were they? And why were they placed there? Leheichen Golan, to where, in the next mission now, to where would these inadvertent killers go to? So the answer is Lori Mikla, to cities of refuge. Now remember, we never really mentioned that yet. We only said Gola, exile. We never said where he goes.
Right.
So now we have to get into the cities of refuge. This is going to focus on the actual cities of refuge. So he goes to the refuge. Where were there and how many were there? The answer is L'shalo Shebever Yarden. There were three on the east bank of the Jordan River. U'l'shalo Sheberetz Canaan. And three on the west bank, the land of Canaan. How do we know that? Shenemar, because it says in the Torah, Eshalosh ha'arim titnu me'ever le'yardei. There are three cities given over on the east bank of the Jordan. Veshalosh ha'arim titnu be'eretz Canaan, and three are in the land of Canaan, which is on the west bank of the Jordan. Another important halacha that we said, Achlo nivcharu shalosh be'eretz Yisrael, until the three cities in Eretz Yisrael were chosen and selected and set up, Lohayu Shalosh Shebever Yarden Koletas. The three on the east bank did not work yet, even though they were set up first. In other words, what happened was, as the Jews were about to go into Eretz Yisrael, and Moshe was still alive, Hashem told Moshe, set up three cities of refuge on the east bank, because we already captured the east bank. So Moshe sets up three cities of refuge on the east bank. However, they don't work yet until three were set up on the west bank. You'll see why in a minute. When did that happen? Well, it didn't happen in Moshe's lifetime. He died before we crossed the Jordan River. So then when the Jews crossed with Yehoshua, and it took 7 years to conquer the land, 7 years to distribute the land. So in the 14th year after entering Canaan, Yehoshua established three cities of refuge on the west side of the Jordan River. Only at that point were the first three now able to work. In other words, the first three that Moshe set up, if somebody would have killed inadvertently, the city of refuge didn't work yet. Okay? Now, it really was a moot point because he set them up days before he died.
Mm-hmm.
And after he died, well, not totally moot point, they all crossed over to the West Bank. So what would you need the East Bank anyway? There's nobody there except women and children. If you remember the next 2 weeks, Parsha from now, Gad, Reuven, the 2.5 tribes, they went out to battle, and they left the women and kids behind. But so it's more of an academic point than a practical point. So the three cities of refuge on the east bank were not, even though they were chosen, but they weren't operational and functional until the other three were established. How do we know this? Shenemar, because the pasuk then says, after it says, put three on the east, put three on the west, do you know how to add three and three? Most people do. So why does the Torah now add, Shenemar, Sheish Ari Mikla, you should have six. Well, I know that 3 and 3 is 6. Why are you telling me that? The point being, only when all 6 are working at the same, do they all work at the same time. That's the point. There are 6. 3 plus 3 we know is 6. But we only do it when all 6 can operate. You don't have 3 operating before the other 3 are operating. So that becomes the point over there.
So during these 14 years, nobody was sent an exile in the East Bank?
That's right.
What did they do with them?
I don't know. I don't know if anybody killed at that point. I don't know. That's a good question. That's a historical question now. That's not a halachic question. And that halacha was, so theoretically, if somebody would have killed on the East Bank, it's not likely that was going to happen because there are young children and women. Usually don't get a lot of murder.
Women could have.
It's possible. It's possible. So I don't know. It's a theoretical question. If they have that, there was no resolution for that.
Okay.
Now, so you got 3 and 3. What else do we do? Well, it doesn't help to have city refuge if people can't get there. And if it's hard to get there. So number one is, U'muchuvanus lahem drachim izu lazu. And direct roads were laid out from city to city. In other words, the roads were constructed, not like over here, so that from any city, there was a direct road leading to one of the refuge cities.
Yeah.
So that is, there were many cities in Israel, beyond refuge cities,
yeah.
But we had to construct roads that you can get there. Because there's no roads, how's he going to get there? Okay, that's number one.
It's not one miklat to another. It's all cities to
all cities. There has to be some kind of trans-city transportation system. You kill in Tzvas, there has to be a way to go from Tzvas to the northernmost city of refuge. All right, you have to have it. If you don't have a city, how do we know this? Shenemar, the Pasuk says, Tachin lecho haderech v'shilashto. You shall prepare the way for yourself, and then divide into thirds. We're going to get to divide into thirds in a minute. We'll talk about that. But the roads have to be prepared so that swift travel is possible. It was the responsibility of the courts to maintain the roads in good repair, free from obstructions or anything that might delay a fleeing person. If the courts failed to carry out this responsibility, thus slowing the flight of a killer and causing to die at the hands of an avenging relative, it was as if the courts were guilty of bloodshed. So you've got to, that means you got to check the roads. What if there's a big storm in Israel and trees fall down and blocking the roads? So they had to make sure that it was okay. Now we come to this point I mentioned outside. And we also, the court would provide for them, the inadvertent killers, 2 scholars to escort them to the city. From the Rambam, it seems the Mishnah's law applies to a killer who is being returned to the city of refuge after he has been sentenced to exile in the court. In other words, now that he has sent this exile, he's going to go, but we're going to send 2 scholars with him. Why? Shema yargenu b'derech, lest the Gol Adam, the Avenger, might kill him, and therefore what will they do? V'yadabru elof. And so I could speak to him to try to assuage him and dissuade him from taking revenge. All right? For example, let's say, do not deal with this person as with a murderer. He acted inadvertently. Really, we want him to go into exile because that'll bring the kapara. We don't want him to get killed. We want to make sure he stays in the city of exile. So, right? The sages prescribe the Torah scholars accompany the killer rather than bodyguards. That's a good question. Right? What about 2 Brinks guys? Yeah. Wouldn't that be a little better? Schwarzeneggers, whatever.
Terminators.
You need 2 Terminators, you know? No, they reasoned that an appeal to the conscience of the Gol Adam would be efficacious, while physical protection might spur the Gol Adam to arrange a large attacking force. So you got 2 guys, I'm going to get a posse of 50 guys, we'll wipe them all out. It would result in more bloodshed. So you send 2 big Rosh Hashivas. Who's going to speak? No one's going to kill a Rosh Hashiva. They're going to speak kindly, say, please don't kill the guy, etc., etc. So who dissuades them? These 2 guys. On the other hand, Reb Meir says, Af hu medar al-yo. He too can speak. The killer himself can speak for himself and his own behalf. And not only the other 2 guys, but he could speak. Shenemar, as it says, we learn from the extra words, Vizet Devar Harotzech, and this is the word of the killer. Now, really, Dvar means matter. This is the matter. This is the topic. But Dvar can also have another meaning of the word. The simply understood, the verse means to say, this is the matter of the murderer. This is the law. The Mishnah, however, homiletically interprets the word in its literal sense. This is the word of the murderer, teaching that he must speak up for himself as well. Other versions of the Mishnah do not have the word af. Also, are some brackets in the text of Rav Meir's statement. According to this reading, Rav Meir disputes the Tanna Kamma and rules that it is the killer's obligation to speak up. He holds that we do not send scholars to speak with Golem. So machlokas how to read this line. Okay, a couple more lines to finish. Maybe we'll just stop right here. There's a lot more to finish the Mishnah. We already went 35 minutes today.